Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Call it a four-year tryout we've just been through of strongman, one-man politics. The election put it to a vote, and the country said, enough for now, but not quite no. The U.S. of A. didn't so much split down the middle as declare itself two states of mind and geography, red and blue, or maybe three, Atlantic, Pacific, and farmland, with the next round in doubt. We feel saved in some sense, but not cured or redeemed. So we do what you do, enlist the soundest of our friends and keep talking with people like Citizen Ralph Nader, Masha Gessen with a Russian twist, Green New Dealer Shoykat Chakrabarty, letter writer Heather Cox Richardson, the noisy Scotsman Mark Blythe, Chris Hedges preaching doom, and the only pundit we truly love, the cranky, angry, Caribbean-American patriot Amber, all next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. And you thought a presidential election could be an exit ramp out of polluted, stuck traffic. And already you know we're in the same old breakdown lane. With ingenious, fresh touches of absurdity, President Trump lost the popular vote and the Electoral College, prompting his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to assure us this week that we are in a peaceful transition to a second Trump administration. What can you do in the breakdown lane but call out for help, or at least for company, or judgment with a jolt? And that's what we're doing this hour with the Open Source family of historians, preachers, politicians, old and young, foreign and domestic. Mark Blythe embodies the type, political economist by title, meaning an all-purpose talker, and our noisy friend in his Scottish pub.
Essentially, what Biden has done is buy everybody 4 years stay of execution. Trump's numbers went up. He got 2 million more than last time. He made inroads into Hispanics, who it turns out can be just as conservative and reactionary as anybody else. He even managed to increase his African-American vote. He picked up more women. The one constituency he lost, surprisingly, was actually working class and college-educated men. So he broadened his base. Trumpism is not going anywhere.
What about Trump?
Trump's going to hold on as long as he can for one final roll of the dice. But even if he goes, the forces that brought Trumpism to power are still there waiting to be harnessed. 30-year build-up in inequality, a massive bifurcation of the ability to earn your crust in the coast versus the heartland, racial inequalities compounding economic inequalities, and then basically a massive groundswell of millions of Americans who don't believe a word that elites say because they're the ones that have run off with all the cash.
What can Joe Biden do in the foreseeable future to affect the tension alive in the country today?
Well, affecting the tension is changing the mood music, and he's able to do that by not being Trump. You're about to find out that the Republicans are about to become very, very concerned with the size of the national debt and the deficit once again. Now the Democrats are back in charge. So you can expect zero cooperation on further stimulus. They basically will want things to suck really badly through the first 2 years. They will go for maximal obstruction on everything. If the Democrats don't manage to pick up two seats in Georgia, then they get absolutely nothing through. And then they hope to basically take that frustration and resentment and weaponize it with the Trump base, even if Trump isn't there, to turn the Democrats out in the midterms and squeeze them even more.
Mark Blythe, you make me wonder if anything's changed at all.
No, here's your upside. And forget all the stuff about decency and alliances and all that sort of stuff. Your upside is you don't politicize the civil service. You don't turn your scientific establishment like the FDA, etc., into basically partisan hacks and to hollow them out from the inside. You rejoin Paris, which is symbolic but not important because ultimately you're not going to get anything through the Senate in terms of doing anything about climate change. And he still hasn't left. Can we focus on this, right? Everyone's talking about this as a done deal, right? Oh, it's just a question of time. Trump's obviously going to step aside. Why? Like, why would he do that? He is in power for the next 88 days. He can cause untold havoc on the way out the door, and why wouldn't he? You know what he's like.
Well, I wonder. The S&P average jumped just on Monday. Biggest leap in a transition since 1932. What does that tell you?
It tells me that the markets don't know what they're doing and they're craving any sign of stability. And now they've convinced themselves that Trump's on the way out the door. They're happy because they think they're going to get their goodies again, which means endless support from the Federal Reserve for the duration of the pandemic and beyond. Mm. And then a nice big wacky federal stimulus, which will basically protect their asset prices even further.
When does it run out? When does it hit the wall? Sorry, folks, it was just a joke.
So long as we have the dollar, so long as there's nothing else to substitute into, so long as the dollar denominates world trade, is regarded as the global safe asset, and so long as the Fed isn't run by a bunch of yahoos, really important that actually that if Biden does take charge, he will not be appointing certain people to the Federal Reserve that Trump would have done, which would have been very dangerous.
Mark Blythe, seriously, the move we worried about after our last conversation that you were leading, you were looking for a country run by a woman, preferably.
Yes, a small open economy with non-polarized politics. That'd be rather nice.
Are you still looking?
Well, I think that we've all got a kind of 4-year stay of execution. I just wonder what happens when somebody who's not as venal and arrogant and tone-deaf as Trump realizes that that constituency, which is basically nationalistic, borderline, if not over the border, racist, extremely inward-looking, backward-looking, anti-science, really, really weaponizes that and brings that forward. That's the point where, yeah, I'm done. It was time to go. So either Biden acts as a bridge to a more stable and reasonable future, which is possible, or alternatively, he himself is a one-term president. And what comes next is Trumpism 2.0, which should carry the health warning, you ain't seen nothing yet.
That was your line, too, that the only cure for this sort of right-wing populism is strong left-wing populism. Where do you see that on the horizon?
So there's two incompatible stories on the ground at the moment, and both of them are true. The first one is, look at Miami, look at Florida. We lost that by saying the word socialism. Americans don't like that.
Right.
Meh. And then there's the other one that says, if it wasn't for lefty progressives and black activists, you wouldn't have got nowhere in Georgia.
Exactly.
You wouldn't be close. You wouldn't have got anywhere in Detroit. You would not have got Michigan. Now, the thing is, both of these things are simultaneously true. So if you're trying to lead that party, what do you do? If you go all in on one side, you will lose on the other side, no matter which one you pick.
Do countries come to their senses? And is there any indication that that's what happened on election day?
It's not a question of coming to your senses. I mean, one of the ways that I described this was, it's almost like people are just so tired of being angry after 4 years. Mm. They look at Biden and think, wow, I could do with a 2-year-long nap. And maybe that's what sort of that represents, that quieting of politics. But what's driving this fundamentally is a deeply unfair political economy, where the rewards are incredibly concentrated, and both parties seek the votes of and the fundings of those who have done the best, while pretending to talk a good game about those who have lost the most. That's fundamentally unsustainable.
Mark, bless your heart. Stick around. We need you, pal.
You know where I am if you need me. In the basement, hiding.
The undocumented freelance pundit known as Amber might be our favorite radio caller over many years. She is an immigrant from the Caribbean living in proud poverty in Dorchester, Massachusetts.
First, did you just call me a pundit? To quote Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones, now you're just insulting me. It feels good to laugh. I'm sorry. And I startle myself these days when I do laugh, because laughter is something that is so missing from life for the last 4 years. What do we see at Codman Square? As I said, we did this. Black women in Georgia, Atlanta, black men in Philadelphia, Native Americans in Nevada and Arizona, people whose lineage is Mexican or Guatemalan or Honduras, in those border states, California, Arizona, New Mexico. We did this. You all informed us that we were, what is the phrase he said? Rat-infested hellholes. By definition, we are the rats infesting these cities, right? So the rats got up and said, no, this is our experiment. This has been our experiment since we came here in chains, or since our forefathers were exterminated on a trail of tears, or since we were kicked out of places with names like Los Angeles. This is our potential victory, because God help us, black people are obsessed with the notion that this experiment cannot fail. it must not fail, and we will stand for 11 hours with babies strapped to our chests, facing down death from COVID, to insist that this experiment will be continued.
I love this part of you. This is the super patriot in you.
The part that still believes there is a reason to stand 11 hours and fight for this. Black people vote because we want to go 50 years in the future and imagine a world where our grandchildren have finally reached that damn mountaintop. White people vote because they want to go back 50 years in the past. Mm. Unfortunately, we may have discovered there is no reconciling those two facts, but we are still determined to keep voting for 50 years in the future. Those are the things we still believe in. Those idiotic words, all men created equally, still give us a tingle. Mm. We still believe in that. We now understand the majority of white Americans do not. The question is, how do we move forward from here?
Read the election returns from last Tuesday, Amber.
It's not unexpected that the day after the New York Times got up and started talking about AOC and Becky with the good hair Spamburger, as if somehow that is where the conversation is. The Queen of America, the woman of the moment, the most important political voice is Stacey Abrams. Mm. And Stacey Abrams is the real Michelle Obama. And we've known that for a while down here in Black America. I've been following Stacey Abrams since she did something that I found quite unexpected and shocking. After losing the Georgia race, she didn't do what Black people are required and expected to do to continue being the favorites of the New York Times, which is she didn't gracefully accept the defeat and just fade away. No, instead, Ms. Abrams pulled up a chair with her big, wide Black hips and her large Black lips and said, "Let me explain to you what just happened. I was cheated and my voters was cheated." She did not hold a bear summit with Brian Kemp, the new governor of Georgia. Instead, she kept explaining and explaining and explaining. The only shot we have of keeping this republic is to outvote the bastards. Mm. And that is what we did last Tuesday. And the remarkable thing about Ms. Abrams is without the attention of an AOC, without the media spotlight of a Ms. Spamburger, she managed to get into the heart of Native American voters in Nevada and Arizona who said, "Hell yes, we will outvote the bastards this time."
Amber, how do you feel about Joe Biden as the man to carry this constitutional vessel, your democracy, our democracy, forward?
It had to be Joe Biden. I can't think of anybody else who would have made it this far. When he finally gave his quote-unquote acceptance speech, the fact that he actually said out loud, "I know you all brought me here and I will not forget. You had my back and I will have yours." I heard my next door neighbor scream when he said that, a woman in the apartment next door, because it was like, oh my God. He has acknowledged the fact that our votes matter, that we matter, that here's the phrase, be prepared for it, Black lives matter. That is all Amber has to say about this election.
Thank you, Amber, for giving us the view from you. Nothing like it.
Thank you, Christopher.
Coming up, writing letters to Abraham Lincoln and channeling Ronald Reagan. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In COVID isolation, but imagining that we're at a long table with a swath of voices we trust to read the election x-ray of a country at sea. Heather Cox Richardson is our letter writer, historian and teacher. She found a new voice for herself this year in an ancient form, the personal posting of letters from an American, as she put it, addressed to Abraham Lincoln, let's imagine, and anybody else who might be interested in the astonishment unfolding day by day. She began in mid-September last year. At the height of the presidential campaign, more than 1 million readers were following her on Facebook and email. Why Abraham Lincoln?
Because Abraham Lincoln was the first American to articulate what you call a multicultural society. Now, mind you, he's blind to gender issues and to indigenous issues, but he understood that our Declaration of Independence had the principles that could be expanded to create a new kind of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Hmm. And he was very articulate about what that meant. It stood firmly on the rule of law and on the principle that nobody was above the law or below the law, that we could have no hierarchies in our society. So if you go back to that principle, I always take a look at, are we standing on the principle that everybody is equal before the law and that nobody is better than anybody else? And, you know, frankly, under this administration, that has virtually never been the case.
I'm impressed that you started a new kind of public conversation. That's most of what I was thinking about when I said this mediated America, neither red nor blue necessarily, but it's digital, it's television, it's visual, it's conversational, and there's something infecting it.
I think that what is infecting it is the ability of, it was actually a movement that came out of the post-World War II period, you know, a group of reactionaries who did not like this liberal consensus from the New Deal and Eisenhower's middle way that regulated business and provided a basic social safety net like Social Security and promoted infrastructure like the Interstate Highway Act.
The post-war bargain, they called it.
Yeah, the post-war bargain, the liberal consensus. And they didn't like that, largely because they didn't like business regulation. They didn't like taxes either, but they really didn't want regulation because it hampered their ability to make scads and scads of money the way they had in the 1920s. And what they figured out early on when William F. Buckley Jr. actually articulated this in a book he wrote in 1951 called God and Man at Yale, he said, you know, we really have to stop this whole idea of the Enlightenment, the idea that you can advance society by making arguments based in fact, because when we do that, people overwhelmingly choose this liberal consensus. Free enterprise and the promotion of the Christian religion are as inviolable, as he said, as the Ten Commandments. And the way to get there is not by trying to reason with people because they disagree with us. The way to get there is to construct a narrative that will convince them that this is the truth and the light. And against it, he posited the capital C conservatives that we now know as movement conservatives who set out to destroy that consensus. And that's really been the driving impulse behind that reactionary thread that now is dominant in the Republican Party. They're surviving solely on this narrative that is, in the end, entirely a false narrative.
It's fascinating. Makes Bill Buckley maybe a more important figure than he was, but it also nails a fundamental question is, are we at war with the Enlightenment? The truth, as the New York Times embraces it.
I think so. Yes, I think that that is exactly what this project is a return to the idea of a country that is run by a few elites who stay in power through religion and traditional narratives. And by traditional, I mean their narratives, a narrative of hierarchy in society. And it's an illiberal in the literal sense narrative, and it's a hideously dangerous one. And crucially in this moment when we're facing the crisis of climate change, it's one in which our planet is at stake.
Heather, of course we're divided. We're an immense country. How do you measure the danger that the whole experiment is in? Are we an endangered country?
Yes, we are. But let me hold it in the same hand as the idea that the opposite of danger and chaos is opportunity. We are indeed on a knife edge, I think, where the American experiment is in terrible danger of falling into not fascism, although there are certainly fascistic tendencies for where we are right now, but rather an oligarchical system that looks much like Russia or any of the countries that are overseen by a very small, very wealthy elite. I think that's been absolutely the direction of the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we are at what is very clearly to me a changing of the guard and the changing of the meaning of America. And the other side of this moment is what seems to me to be enormously exciting. We have new technologies. We have now the opportunity to include so many more voices in our democracy. To me, when I look at it, I feel like I have spent most of my life seeing our national political world as being a series of shades of whites and grays and blacks. And I look across this moment and I see a future of young people and different voices and different experiences and new ideas coming from populations that have not been fully included in the past. And to me, it looks like an absolute carnival of color. But the opportunities we have to create something new are just so exciting. I think we really do have an opportunity to make a new kind of American democracy that really truly is once and for all what Abraham Lincoln said, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Heather Cox Richardson, thank you for creating a new conversation in this country.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Heather Cox Richardson has kept her day job as a professor of American history at Boston College. The Civil War and Reconstruction, her specialties, and the modern conservative movement from Bill Buckley and Barry Goldwater in the 1950s forward. Rick Perlstein is an obsessively fine-grained, shockingly entertaining historian of contemporary conservatism. His new 900-page brick of a book on the subject is called Reaganland, which will do as the name of the landscape that we still live in 40 years later.
Well, as I like to say, and as you learn in your first day of History 101, history is the study of continuity and change. And this is just a perfect exemplar of that. You know, in my book, Reaganland, I write about, you know, what he actually believed. And a lot of it was quite extreme and quite radical and quite consonant with the kind of things we've seen from Trump. For example, I talk about a radio broadcast he gave in 1978 in which he proposed overturning the law that gave the Food and Drug Administration the authority to certify that drugs were safe and effective, right? Which is, you know, pretty radical. But he was also, as you know, surrounded by, you know, the metaphor is adults in the room, right? The James Bakers and the Michael Devers, who, you know, he followed, right, for political advice. He was always taking the temperature of what was possible. But what did he want to accomplish? You know, what was his dream, right? And I think it was quite extreme and quite radical and very Trump-like in many ways. But by the same token, there's that very key difference between himself and Donald Trump. And that's, of course, that Donald Trump has never taken the temperature of the room or listened to the adults in the room. Mm-hmm. He just kind of plunged forward no matter what. So that's a very huge difference.
I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan, a mannerly,
yes, the kind, polite, optimistic. Yes, the rhetoric is profoundly different.
Also, who could be very, very forceful at saying the government is the problem, not the solution. And he was adept, maybe more than anyone originally, at the dog whistle. Not quite saying what he really meant.
I actually don't describe what he does as dog whistles because I think he really believed he was coming from a place of innocence. He did not have that cynicism. And his ability to project kind of good intentions and decency, even when he was saying things that had very cruel effects, really was, you know, what made Ronald Reagan Ronald Reagan. Donald Trump also borrow something from Ronald Reagan. And that's this kind of rhetoric that you can't criticize America because America is the greatest country in the world. So when he says, oh, sure, I lied about, you know, what I knew about COVID-19 because, you know, my job is to be the cheerleader for America. That's one of the entailments that Ronald Reagan gave us that Donald Trump picked up on.
Can you imagine a conversation between, in some sense, the start of conservative politics in power and the Trump endpoint? I mean, the air of innocence in Ronald Reagan's head, but also that hard tax cut ideology come to Trump, immensely cynical, but the master of so many entertainment tricks.
Right. They're both reality TV stars. Don't forget that Ronald Reagan, you know, became most famous before his political career, not for his movies, but for hosting the General Electric Theater, in which, you know, each episode had like a 5-minute commercial for GE in between. And they often were the Reagan family at home, which presented them kind of to the world as fully formed characters, much as Donald Trump was presented to the world in The Apprentice.
Imagine Ronald Reagan sitting with Donald Trump talking about their messages, their messaging, their manners. how does it go? And what's the level of debt and disappointment either way?
I think that there is an absolute possibility that Ronald Reagan would figure out a way, in that incredibly gifted way he had, to excuse Donald Trump's ugliness. I mean, look at some of the people he supported and who supported him for his, you know, presidential run in 1980 and during his presidency, like Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell was a guy who would go on stage and he would say during a gay rights referendum in a place like Miami, gays are just as likely to kill you as look at you. Right. I mean, that is a feral kind of nasty, bigoted cruelty as ugly as anything Donald Trump would say. And yet Ronald Reagan found a way to make his peace with it. The fact of the matter is that the conservative movement, both out of power and in power, has always had very nasty elements. And one of the ways that it kind of managed to achieve power was to have, you know, front men, frankly, like Ronald Reagan, who were very good at kind of hiving off those nasty sides of it. And the most important transition from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump is that project to basically hide the nastiness from the public or from the media was no longer required.
Donald Trump is unelected. What is the unspent force of this movement, this thinking, this style of politics?
Well, that is the open question. That is very frightening, right? I mean, he has opened up a Republican Party to open insurrection against the institutions of democracy. And will the so-called, you know, adults in the room return back to a world in which the most feral and open kind of demagoguery are not acceptable in their party? And that's for them to answer.
Thank you for these books. They're incredible.
Chris, I adore you. Thank you for all you do.
Bless you, man. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Chris Hedges is a newspaper man whose scope keeps widening, from battlefields that he covered for the New York Times to the book he began in divinity school called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Chris Hedges' last book was America, The Farewell Tour. I asked him, what does it matter that the Trump piece of the story is almost over?
Well, not much, unless the ruling elites address the root causes that gave rise to Trump. And I think the analytics of this election show that the anger at the betrayal by the two ruling parties and the ruling financial elites and the media cuts across racial and even to a certain extent class lines. And that's what gave rise to this right-wing populism. And my fear is that, and I think the Biden campaign has signaled this, is that they are going to go back to what they call normal. That really means the rise of a competent fascist. I mean, Trump was utterly inept, even at being a fascist. But there are many people out there who will ride this right-wing popular rage to power if the Democrats don't wake up.
Well, we'll see. I mean, in language, in emotion, in public presentation, there's nothing of the fascist about Joe Biden. How will you monitor him by policy?
Well, we know what to expect from Joe Biden. He has a long track record. He was one of the architects of NAFTA and the free trade deals.
Mm-hmm.
He passed the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill.
Mass incarceration.
Almost doubling mass incarceration numbers and tripling or quadrupling sentences. He was involved in the destruction of breaking down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks by repealing Glass-Steagall. He, you know, they didn't talk in the campaign very much about Supreme Court justices appointments because Biden was one of the engines behind two of the worst Supreme Court justices in modern history, Clarence Thomas and Anton Scalia. He was a cheerleader for the war in Iraq. He's an abject supporter of the apartheid state in Israel. He was part of the architect behind wholesale surveillance. He has called in the past for cuts to Social Security. So I think that Biden's past record, along with the statements that are coming out of the campaign, including refusing to support the Green New Deal, supporting fracking, refusing to address the punitive levels of student debt, and then him telling the 1% of the 1% during the campaign that he wouldn't impose new regulations, along, of course, with the squandering of resources in endless wars and the defense budget. I mean, all of these are combining with the pressures of the pandemic, which are not just health pressures, and that in the end, Biden's response to the pandemic is crippled by the fact that we are chained to this for-profit healthcare industry, which is not designed to deal with the national health emergency. It's designed to make profits. So if Biden doesn't institute radical measures to address the misery and suffering and the feelings of legitimate feelings of betrayal and alienation, then we are going to follow the trajectory that other countries like Brazil or Hungary have followed.
Chris Hedges, I get a sense of Joe Biden that he's embarrassed by that record, his own record, especially the war in Iraq and the crime bill. What room do you allow, just as a human being, for people being scared straight or turning around, or the country being scared straight by the ugliness of the Trump era?
Well, the country's scared straight. I don't think the donor class of the Democratic Party is scared straight. And they made it very clear that should Bernie Sanders become the nominee, I'm quoting Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs and others, they would vote for Trump. Biden brings back the kind of decorum and the gravitas to the imperial presidency that the oligarchs want, which is why he got so much more money than Trump. But the fact is, the oligarchs could have lived with Trump. He's vulgar and crude and all the things we know, but they certainly weren't going to, they were terrified of the rise of a left-wing populism. And really on the political spectrum, as you know, Bernie wasn't even that left, but he was beginning to speak in a language that correlated to the reality that most Americans are enduring. And we saw Bernie mount a very credible challenge to the hierarchy of the Democratic Party. But everything that they have done, including sabotaging the other primary candidates to ensure that Biden was anointed, I think signals that they're not at all ashamed. I think they're completely out of touch. All you have to do is get in a car and drive out of some of these bubbles. I live in one, Princeton. I don't have to drive far to Trenton, Camden, Newark, Jersey City, and you can see the physical rot that is ripping apart the country, the political, moral, and economic decay that feeds the rise of figures like Trump. But of course, this time around, it'll feed people like Tom Cotton or I don't know who it'll be, cloaked in this kind of Christian fascism.
Chris Hedges, thank you. We can't say we weren't warned.
All right, Chris, take care.
Coming up, the heirs of Ralph Nader and Marcia Gessen with a tyranny test. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're at a virtual roundtable with a sample of the post-game, post-election talkers we like, people who might tell you your coat or your country was on fire. Ralph Nader and Shoykat Chakrabarty are public citizens and reformers born half a century apart. Marcia Gessen is the hawk-eyed lookout on authoritarian politics in Russia and the United States. Have we survived autocracy?
We have not yet survived autocracy. We are on track to reverse an autocratic attempt. But we have to be really careful about how we go about it.
Marcia, you write that Joe Biden, assuming he gets to be president, has got to see and dismantle what Donald Trump did. I mean, hands across the aisle politics, consensus politics, bipartisanship is no longer enough. What would he have to do?
You know, I think we need a wholesale reinvention, right? And we can think about it institutionally, we can think about it spiritually, we can think about it culturally. But we really need to ask what made this possible?
Right.
What it made it possible, you know, in the gerontocratic political duopoly that we call our two-party system. in the concentration of power in the executive branch, in the marriage of money and politics, in the possibility of creating a monopoly on political power. Now, this is something really interesting. Again, students of autocracy raise a red flag when there's a monopoly on political power. And by monopoly on political power, I mean the trifecta of the executive and the two chambers of the legislature belonging to the same party. We have created a system, not just in the federal government, but throughout this country, where government is only really functional when it has a trifecta.
Right. Good old Lyndon Johnson ran the whole thing.
And it reached its sort of apogee in the confrontation of Congress and the executive branch under Barack Obama. But it has really entrenched this idea that unless you have a monopoly on political power, you're not going to be able to get anything done. We need to address this straight on. This is a huge weakness in our system as it's evolved. It is something that actually precludes checks and balances. And looking at it from the point of view of the entire country, beyond the political system, we need a reckoning. There's this really strong idea that's been around, particularly since Ford pardoned Nixon, that there's a kind of virtue in moving on. Right? And there's a real continuum from that to Obama's decision not to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate illegal detention under George W. Bush.
Or look again hard at the Iraq War.
Or look again hard at the Iraq War, a war that was based on what we know were false premises, what we know were public lies. And what that actually establishes is that once you get beyond a certain level of political power, you act with impunity. That's kind of a terrifying thing in a democracy, to basically establish as a given that beyond a certain level, politicians would not be held accountable. That is as undemocratic as you can get.
I hear you saying that Donald Trump lost the election, but somehow the authoritarian or autocratic model has had a proof of concept this last 4 or 5 years. When will we know we've escaped it?
That's a really great way of putting it. Well, we're not going to know for another 4 or 8 years. You know, one of the scariest things that I've been thinking about in the last few days is we have 70 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump. That's a major political movement, right? We spent 4 years, wasted 4 years, really, trying to pretend that it was Russian interference. It wasn't. Donald Trump is the conscious choice of more than 70 million American voters.
You don't have nightmares of Donald Jr. or Ivanka or return?
I totally have nightmares of the Trump children running for office and winning in 4 years or 8 years.
Wow. What's your advice to Joe Biden, an instinctive palsy politician?
My advice to Joe Biden is that he should have a reckoning. He should go against every instinct that he has. And instead of saying it's going to be healing for us to try to sweep this under the rug, and use his kind, decent grandpa persona to say, look, we have a deep, deep wound in our social psyche. Let's hash this out and then move on. And lead a national reckoning, lead a national handling of the trauma that we have lived through over the last 4 years, the trauma of being complicit in the war on immigrants. No matter what we did, we were complicit in it. The trauma of seeing the government, you know, in the face of a deadly pandemic say, your lies are worthless, disposable. We can't just sweep that under the rug. We can't like pack it away and go on with it. It's too much, and it's too much for us to deal with without national leadership.
Yeah. Marcia, that's really marvelous.
And now I have to run and do school pickup.
Do it. Do it. Without thanks and blessing, Marcia, you're an incredibly individual voice, and we're thrilled to have you on our air as often as we can.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed 50 years ago about Chevrolet's sporty Corvair. He's the public citizen who brought us, among other things, seatbelts in every car.
Well, I think a lot of us expected a landslide by the Democrats against the worst and most vicious and bigoted and indentured to Wall Street Republican Party in history. Instead, we got a huge loss by the Democrats, except Biden squeaked out the Electoral College win in a few states against Trump. That's a big triumph, obviously. But the Democrats did not recover the Senate, even though twice the number of Republicans were up. They lost seats in the House of Representatives. They didn't flip a single state legislature. And they didn't know how to talk to blue-collar workers. And so here we go again. The conservative instincts of Joe Biden will be rationalized by him every time he can't get anything past Mitch McConnell, the tyrant of the Senate.
This is an important point. As long as I've known you, you preach citizen activism around particular issues, and it can work spectacularly. Why does the Democratic Party rely instead on flooding the zone with TV advertising, which flopped again in the state races last week?
Well, the short answer is they never learn from their past defeats. They don't look in the mirror. They scapegoat. And they're in the thrall of these political media consultants who have a very strong bias in two ways. One, they get their money mostly from corporate clients between elections, so they're conflicted. And second, they want that 15% commission on the billions of dollars of television ads instead of urging the ground game, instead of doing what Trump did, which led to getting out a big Trump vote. They were on the ground. They were in the streets and neighborhoods. They were knocking doors or putting leaflets there. They were telephoning. The Democrats think that if they get more money than Republicans, and they outspend them almost 2-1, that that's all the road to success. But it isn't. And we've seen it again and again that the Democrats do not know how to talk to the very important swing voter, the blue-collar voter that has deserted the Democrats since Reagan days.
What's the Nader book on Joseph Biden of Delaware all these years, Ralph?
Joe Biden is a corporate Democrat. He comes from the corporate state of all the United States, Delaware. We used to call him Corporate Joe. He represented the banks, the credit card companies. He made it hard for students to go bankrupt. They couldn't pay their student loans. He was not the go-to guy in the Senate for consumer or environmental progress. Now, he's got a new moment in history. He's got far greater crises in the country. He's got a progressive wing pressuring him. But he's not going to get that done if the Senate is in Mitch McConnell's hands, the tyrant of the Senate, who really knows how to block things. He calls himself the guardian of gridlock. He calls himself the Grim Reaper. Those are his words. And he gets reelected easily in Kentucky. That's how weak the Democratic Party is in Kentucky. So Joe Biden has to be pushed. And you'll see that his cabinet nominees are going to be Clinton-era types, Obama-era types. Nothing that will reflect the surge of millions of voters, many of them young voters, representing the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren primary initiatives.
Right. They swallowed their pride and their best instincts in voting for him. He owes them something.
He owes them something, but he has something in return. He can tell them, you got nowhere to go. Where are you going to go?
Thank you, Ralph. Always a pleasure. I'm glad you're watching.
Yeah, keep calling, Chris. Thank you.
You could picture Shoykat Chakrabarty as a Ralph Nader successor, an educated change agent. He was the young prospector who persuaded Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to run for Congress in 2018. My question this week was why the progressive issues, like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, turned out to be more popular than their candidates in 2020.
My take on it is you've got one side, which is the Republican side, which is sort of unified in what their message is and what they're offering. Their message is, America, you're getting screwed. And the reason you're getting screwed is because of the immigrants coming in from Mexico and these trade deals. What we're going to do is we're going to lower your taxes and we're going to kick out all the immigrants and basically shrink the pot in order to like have more for everybody. It's a worldview that is internally coherent. It's a message that's easy to deliver. And if you don't have a message fighting against that, then you lose. a lot of these moderate Democrats, if you look at, you know, the attacks that were actually running in their races, you know, Abigail Spanberger's race, she wasn't being attacked for being too tied to AOC. She was being attacked for being too tied to Nancy Pelosi. What do you do in that scenario? Do you run away from that? No, I think like the smart thing to do would be to define who you are and what you run for, what someone like Katie Porter has done, what Mike Levin has done, and what, you know, Joe Biden honestly did in the presidential race.
You say that the Democrats ran behind their issues. Take Florida as an example of a puzzle to me. An environmentally vulnerable place to begin with. Michael Bloomberg put in $100 million to defeat Donald Trump, but the president won it.
It essentially boils down to, can you convince voters to buy into a little bit of a leap of faith of doing something bigger versus the message that Trump is able to deliver, which is a message of essentially xenophobia and blocking immigration. And, you know, there's some tactical stuff here as well. Like, I actually think the Trump campaign probably did a better job of doing outreach to conservative Latino voters in Florida, whereas the Democratic Party has this sense, and I can tell you this from firsthand experience, they believe that the demographic shift in America is just naturally going to go their way. And so they don't have to do very much to win that vote. And I think that's going to bite them. And it did bite them this time around 100%. You know, Trump got a much larger share of the Latino vote than anyone expected. Trump got a larger share of votes from people of color than I think any Republican in something like 50 or 60 years. It's still a minority of the share. He still only got something like 20%. That to me says Democrats are failing to deliver their message, especially to those voters. And many of those voters, what they're hearing instead is, these folks are taking us for granted, we'll screw them. And I'm going to do the vote to blow up the system, which is what the vote for Donald Trump often is.
The Massachusetts model we saw in Ed Markey's resurrection did not seem to apply. There was an old boomer, 40 years in Congress, saved really by AOC and the young activists around the Green New Deal. Why didn't we see that elsewhere in the country?
The very things I'm saying that these swing seat Democrats ran away from, Markey embraced it. Markey embraced having a message and something to stand on, and he embraced the campaign tactics of this younger generation who, quite honestly, know how to do digital better. And that's where people are. People have the sense, you know, the Democratic Party still has a sense, this sort of elite kind of looking down your nose at the whole internet. You know, it's ridiculous.
Interesting.
That's like the sort of mentality, because the people running the Democratic Party, right, they won their office in the 70s and 80s, you know, and the internet is still seen as like this toy. It's not just young people on the internet. Most people are getting their news from Facebook, from social media. TV ads are just not the future.
Typically, the progressives did sign up with Joe Biden. What does he owe you at this point, if anything?
I don't think Joe Biden owes progressives anything. What I do think is, if Joe Biden doesn't govern the way he campaigned, he's going to lose in 2024 and Democrats are going to lose in 2022. It's as simple as that.
So what has he got to do?
We've got these basic problems. Massive pandemic. We have tens of millions of people out of work. And we've got climate change. These are not like progressive or conservative issues. These are just facts of the world. It's like me saying you've got a deadly disease, you know, and then you don't go and ask what's the progressive opinion or conservative opinion on how to fix this deadly disease. You fix it, right?
True.
Biden has to do, I would say, a massive mobilization of the economy, giant stimulus to get us out of a Great Depression. It could be a greater depression than we faced in the 1940s. If he doesn't do that, if people don't feel a real difference in their life in, honestly, the next 2 years, Democrats will get punished for that. And I think the fact that he wants to solve climate change, this is a historic opportunity to use that mobilization to make massive advances towards climate change, show people that solving climate change is actually going to make everyone's lives better, not worse. And he's got to get a handle on COVID. You know, it's not just going to be a vaccine. He campaigned saying, you know, I would do a better job than Trump if I was president. Well, then you got to show us.
I was fascinated that AOC is talking about the homestead. Not sure she's going to run again. Where do you see new energy, including hers, but people being energized by this crazy year, 2020?
I can say with firsthand evidence that she is not making that up. She has talked to me about her homestead plans if this doesn't work out. The way I think about it is, you know, when I started Brand New Congress back in 2016, AOC didn't exist. You know, she was just one of those people that we talked to that no one had ever heard of, who is now 4 years later, one of the biggest leaders in, you know, Democratic politics in the country. There's 90% chance that the next AOC or whoever is someone that you've never heard of, who may not even be entirely engaged in politics, that maybe just got engaged in the 2020 election. But that's the beauty of the young generation, is it's not people that are already there. It's going to be tons and tons of new people.
Sum it up. How are we feeling a week after this election, not quite settled even now?
I feel like we were drowning and we just managed to get up and get a quick breath of air, but we're still like out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So this is the hard part. I think we've managed to stop the hemorrhaging. It's going to boil down to how much are all these young leaders who have popped up over the last 2 to 4 years, how much are they willing to push and how much is Biden willing to do? Even without the Senate, there's quite a bit he can do if he chooses to be bold. A lot of this sort of backbiting from the establishment sort of wing of the Democratic Party in the House doesn't give me confidence. It's so frustrating because it's sort of letting your own egos and your own personal cares get in the way and cloud your ability to actually do something for this desperate American population. You know, things are really bad. Like,
yeah.
And I hope they're able to actually take a leap of faith and do something big, because there's really honestly no other option. The path of doing nothing has sort of come to a dead end. And I think everyone realizes that.
Shoika Chakrabarty, thank you. We take you seriously and we want to stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks to the Open Source extended family, especially Masha Gessen, Shoika Chakrabarty, Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, Rick Perlstein, Heather Cox Richardson, Mark Blythe, and Amber. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Mary McGrath, with remote help from Adam Coleman, who has just co-produced the first Open Source baby. Welcome, Iris Coleman. Max Liebman engineered the show. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.